Did you know that in today's United States of America, for just trying to handle your own pain, you can get 25 years in prison for drug trafficking? Well, if you don't believe it or you think I'm exaggerating, hang in there. You want to hear this show.
Like a gangster, saw you grabbing the controls. Now you're almost out of batteries. You got a sweater much too small. Poking at your navel. Point your finger to. You say your lips don't even stick together when the dust comes up. Blowing across the plains. Pictures are falling in and out of the frame. Singing good and evil.
Oh, yo. This is Mike Levine, and this is the Expert Witness Radio Show, and Mark Marshall is here with me.
Howdy, folks.
And working those dials, doing that magic, and Mark, I swear, I was undercover federal narcotic agent for 25 years. I've worked with every federal agency there is, and I have spent the last 15 years as a trial consultant and an expert witness in court, and I keep saying, you know, I have heard it all. I've now seen it all.
And then, oh, no, you haven't.
And then up comes our next guest. And what I learned over the last couple of weeks, going through my next guest's website, checking the data, back-checking on some of the court cases, just has me astonished and frightened for this country. You and I and others predicted that after the terrorist act that we predicted was going to happen, we want to lose our rights. We wouldn't recognize this country. And you know what? The show that we're going to have today just about is what we predicted. It's just a frightening harbinger of, some horrific things just over the horizon and horrific things that are happening to our system of justice, to the American people right this minute. People are listening to us here in New York City right now on WBAI 99.5 FM. I know if you believe me, guys, I know this is traffic time. You're all heading home within 60, 70 miles, you're out of range. You want to stop your car. And if you don't stop your car, because we need you to spread the word about the things that we're talking about. And if you happen to miss this show, you only catch part of it, you can hear it free of charge for the next week on our website, expertwitnessradio.org. Again, I urge you to spread the word. And I don't care what your political persuasion is. I don't care if you wear a white sheet on the weekends. This is something you all want to rebel against. Something that makes me ashamed. And you'll hear why. My guest is Siobhan Reynolds. Siobhan, am I pronouncing it right?
Yes, you are.
You know, I come with the handicap of being a Bronx boy.
Yeah, you got two of them here, so you're in trouble.
Oh, yeah, two.
I'll do my best.
Siobhan has a website, and it's called... Well, did you hear my introduction to the show, Siobhan?
Yeah, it's painreliefnetwork.org.
Yeah, but my introduction about... that you can do 25 years in prison, be charged with drug trafficking just for going out and trying to get medication for your own pain.
Yeah. Well, that's because of a Florida law that has mandatory sentences set at a just ridiculous level. So that, and what goes on in Florida, which is amazing, is that they actually count the amount of substance, not the drug, you know, just the acetaminophen. 95% of the drug weight that Richard Pay, I think is who you're talking about,
yeah,
was sentenced for was acetaminophen. I mean, and we were just, when the lawyer was doing the argument on his appeal, he was saying, what if it was tapioca? What if it was, you know, I mean, how ridiculous is this going to get?
Well, Richard Pay, we're going to get into the specifics of the Richard Pay case and some of the cases that I worked as an expert witness in and as a trial consultant in cases of medical marijuana, where I've actually been successful, and these are important to put out over the year.
I wanted to inject this before too. If you folks go to the website and you go to the archives, there are previous shows we've done, and you can find links to them on the website now, right on the page for the show. But we've done previous shows about this.
Yeah,
about this very thing happening.
Yeah, some of the cases that where I've actually participated involving medical marijuana in arrests and immense charges. They saddened and depressed me because, you know, for all the years that I was working as an undercover agent working internationally, I always got a great joy out of going after bad people, people who I knew, even though they were drug traffickers, but they were murderers. They belonged in cages, and I got great satisfaction in putting them there. But the people now being investigated, prosecuted at a cost of millions and millions and millions of dollars per head are hardworking people. They don't sell drugs. They don't do anything but try to, they're cursed, afflicted with pain that they cannot handle, and they go out and try to handle this pain, and we're gonna even bring in the reaction of
Let's play a clip.
Yeah, well, let's open the show by playing Siobhan Reynolds during a recent newscast. Go ahead, Mark. Run it.
This is Eyewitness News.
A startling statistic tonight. Some 15 million Americans abuse prescription drugs. That's double the number just 10 years ago. The abuse is causing a crackdown on doctors. Some say could keep them from giving patients the medicines they need.
I became utterly incapacitated.
Sean Greenwood has excruciating pain from a connective nerve disorder. He needs massive amounts of drugs to get any relief.
This is absolutely as necessary for the continuance of my life as for a diabetic to get insulin.
But Sean worries about being able to get the medication he needs. In 2001, the DEA began a crackdown on OxyContin, a powerful pain medication prescribed by doctors, but often abused. There have been high-profile arrests of doctors and raids in doctors' offices, but some, including the Cato Institute, say in its zeal, the DEA is punishing legitimate physicians and intimidating many more.
Not only are innocent doctors getting caught in the net, but lots of other doctors are getting scared.
Last year, DEA was involved in the arrest of only 42 doctors nationwide, one out of 23,000 doctors.
But Siobhan Reynolds of the Pain Relief Network says the effect is widespread and people are suffering.
So many people are being destroyed. Families are being torn apart. Children are going without pain medication. Children with cancer are going without pain medication.
Doctors who are prescribing medications legitimately for pain management have nothing to worry about from the Drug Enforcement Administration.
But nonetheless, Sean Greenwood worries.
I cower in fear that I'm going to be one of the many that lose their medication for, you know, whatever reason.
And you could have added, lose their liberty, as you're about to hear, is what's happening. But you know what? I think the best thing to do, Siobhan, is for you. You are one of the people directly affected by this.
Yeah.
I'd like you to just tell the audience how, you know, your own story and what inspired you to become one of the very, very few activists in this area that is, well, you're sorely needed.
Sorely in need of activists.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it is sorely in need of activists, and I became involved because I found out the hard way, which is how everyone finds out, that there really isn't available care for people with severe pain. And the report that you just aired was with my ex-husband, who I still live with and take care of, because he has a high-dose pain requirement. And when it first happened, when he first got severe pain, back in, say, the very early 90s, you know, there wasn't anybody to give him anything. I mean, nobody would give him anything, and we didn't know why. We thought, oh, you know, they're just out of date or whatever. And the more I started to explore it and the pain movement started to come on in the 90s, doctors started actually treating the pain. So he started actually being able to get the medications, although not with the kind of ease like you would anything else, you know, like any kind of antibiotic or something. But it was, he did get more, and we did find out that, yes, that's the stuff that works. Yes, that will keep him from committing suicide. Yes, it is the medicine that he needs. And then really, just as quickly as you can say, you know, in 2001, you're exactly right, the government turned around and just went and cracked down on doctors that treat pain. And as a result, we started living in, you know, a terrible state of fear. And in fact, the doctor who'd actually given him the dose that he really required, which was a lot, because he'd been left in pain for so many years, and that's the thing people don't understand, is that pain begets pain. So he'd been left in pain for so long, he finally found Dr. Hurwitz in Washington, D.C., in Virginia. Dr. Hurwitz gave him a really serious dose of medication. And very shortly thereafter, Dr. Hurwitz was arrested and subsequently has been convicted, and he's in prison now for 25 years. And so, you know, patients of doctors like that end up trying to find help. You can imagine, the doctors don't want to touch them because they think that this patient's somehow bringing it with them, you know, that they're a bad patient. And I think that the DEA and the other law enforcement organizations that are involved in this effort have no idea how much they're scaring people. And how much this is affecting innocent people and their families. I mean, it's unbelievable.
In the cases like the one that you're describing, do you know, you may not know this, is the DEA or is there anyone who's actually looking at these cases from a medical perspective? I mean, outside of the practitioner, obviously, but is there anybody who's looking along with the DEA and evaluating it ahead of time and going, okay, before we go shutting this guy down, are in fact the cases that he's dealing with really people with severe pain? Do you know if they're doing that at all?
No, my understanding is that they don't. They have the opportunity because they work with medical boards, and the medical, but you see, in each of the instances where the medical boards have been consulted and the medical boards have said, look, we may not disagree with, we may not agree with this guy's practice of medicine in one way or another, and we'll deal with that, but we'll let him practice because he's in good faith. He's not drug dealing. And the DEA shouldn't get involved because it's not a drug dealing matter, right? It's a bad medical practice or maybe a questionable medical practice or whatever. But what happens is that any time that happens, when these guys get a negative opinion, in other words, when a medical source says, no, we think that you guys should leave it alone, they don't listen. They go ahead anyway.
Well, have you followed any of these cases through court? Because that's what interests me.
I've been at court in many of these cases.
Well, let me ask you this. I've been called in cases. So we'll give you an example. I've been called in a couple of medical marijuana cases where people who had permits in California to take – they actually had cancer. They had other diseases. They were in horrific pain. And they were growing marijuana, and they had licenses to distribute marijuana, et cetera. But they were limited by an amount. And, of course, DEA, sheriffs, deputies, helicopters, SWAT teams would suddenly swoop down on these people.
Mm-hmm.
We did a show. One is still a fugitive now, Renee Bourget. We did a show. It's back in our archives. I urge you guys to hear it.
You'll see it, right? This is one of the shows I was referring to before. You'll see it right when you go to the page for this site. You'll see links to those right at the bottom.
It's called Renee the Fugitive Show.
Yeah, Big Bad Renee.
Yeah, she's been a fugitive for almost 10 years now, or 7 or 8 years, ever since there was a medical marijuana. And the thing about it, when you get to court, is if you have a bad lawyer defending you, he doesn't understand that when government agents get on the witness stand or police get on the witness stand, the jury is taking their words as an expert. So if you have a government agent or a prosecutor saying, well, you know, if so-and-so had 200 pounds of marijuana or 100 and he had only a permit for 50, that's proof that he is a drug dealer. Now, what they don't do is an investigation that would show that the person is a drug dealer. They simply say, you've got to take our word for it because he had this amount of marijuana. But for instance, if they did an investigation and try to link his phone calls with real drug traffickers, if they did surveillance and try to catch him really selling drugs, if they checked his lifestyle and bank accounts to see if he was living the life of a drug trafficker instead of a cancer victim, all of that would have come up negative.
Mm-hmm.
The only trouble is the lawyers who defend them don't even do that. And these people end up getting convicted for drug trafficking when, with a qualified expert to take the stand and say, well, no, you know, I'm trained in narcotic investigation. I train people in narcotic investigation. There are a series of steps to show whether he be a doctor or a medical marijuana user or a pain user. There are a series of steps that the government can show and take to prove that this person is, in fact, a narcotics trafficker.
Right.
But if they don't take those steps, well, that's avoidance of the exculpatory.
Right, I agree with you.
So what happens is, and I think this happened with Mr. Pei, who's now serving 25 years,
Wait, hang on just for a second. Yeah. I think you two should really quickly talk about Richard Pei and the story so that people know, when you refer to him, what happened to him.
Yeah, bring our audience through the Richard Pei case carefully, because I really want to explore this. I believe from my experience that Richard Pei, now serving 25 years in prison, who never sold a drug in his life, he was only handling pain, is somebody who we can use as a model for how not to defend. I'm not sure. You know, I can't. I need your opinion.
That's a hard one because I've had a lot of different opinions about how he was defended. It was absolutely out on the table that he had not sold any pills. The prosecutors knew that he had not sold any pills.
And what were they going after him for?
Drug trafficking. Because it's a statutory thing. It's like Mike was just saying. If you are above a certain amount of drug, you are by definition a trafficker. It's not that you have to have trafficked, which is a real problem with the way we've done things in our country. You know, because it would be good to stick to the facts. You know, when you're writing statutes.
I was going to say I can't see this being applied to say drunk driving. Well, you were driving. You weren't drunk, but you could have been. Or you were drinking, but you weren't driving, but you could have been driving. So therefore,
yeah.
Oh, man.
No, but it's because we've made these exceptions to logic with drug laws, unfortunately, and that's one of them. You know, sort of presumptive possession for sale. All you really have is a knowing possession. And plus, with Richard, the case was that he had been involved with his doctor in an arrangement. His doctor was up here in New Jersey, and Richard couldn't get any meds at that level of dosing from his doctors in Florida, so he continued his relationship with his doctor up here. And the doctor here was very kind to continue it. I mean, because it scares doctors you can imagine, to go over state lines or do anything that might draw federal attention.
Well, tell us about Richard Pei. I mean, what we described, the man was in a wheelchair. Describe the kind of pain he was in and how long he was in pain. And was he living the lifestyle of a drug dealer? Tell the audience what was brought in. This was brought into a Florida court or a federal court?
Yeah, it was brought into a Florida state court, although at the beginning it was initiated, and then very much DEA played a major role in it.
I have a feeling if you go back and you got the appropriate discovery, or you found why it did not go in federal court, was because some federal prosecutor with a soul looked at the case and said, I'm not going to go forward with this.
I really don't know, but it's possible for sure. And I wouldn't. I mean, it's hard to imagine. The guy that ultimately did his appeal, who's a wonderful attorney named John Flannery, used to be a federal drugs prosecutor. He was a federal prosecutor here in the Southern District of New York.
Okay.
And he says the same thing, you know, that he's astonished that anybody would have looked at this and have gone ahead. The same exact thing, that there's a calculus by which we do determine if people are drug dealing or not, and clearly Richard was not. Richard had been in a car accident at age, I don't remember what age, but he was in his early 30s, and he was in law school at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was like everybody else who ends up in a severe accident or chronic pain. They don't think this could be the rest of my life. They just keep trying to find help. And he tried a bunch of different things that didn't work. One was surgery. And they did this terrible experimental surgery called pedicle screw implants. And they put them in his back. Very dangerous thing. And now they're all messed up in there. They're so bad they don't feel they should even take them out. They feel if they take them out, they'll hurt him even more. So he ultimately became paralyzed. He developed multiple sclerosis. But he and his wife moved forward in their lives anyway, and it had children, and he had thought, you know, again, he, like we did too, we always think, oh, if there's hope, you'll get better. And so they had three little kids, and his wife is an optometrist, and she had been in the Army, and they're really a wonderful family. And she was going to work and taking care of the family while he was home, sort of on his back, you know, doing the best he could, struggling along, not getting enough medication, but getting, you know, enough to where he wasn't you know, unable to get out of bed. And so when he was in that relationship with his doctor, that was the arrangement they had. And so Richard would take prescriptions that were, in essence, faxed from New Jersey and take them into the pharmacy. But every time, the pharmacist would call and check and make sure that that these were authorized. This wasn't that this guy was just making them up by himself. Well, he was being observed, and the pharmacy cops and the DEA and everybody watching all this, and they thought, a guy like that just can't need that much medicine. That's the determination they came to themselves. Because, you see, what's happened is that...
Go back a second. You know, as your attorney pointed out, you know, in his estimation, yes, they didn't meet the parameters of an investigation that would show a man to be a drug dealer. And I agree. I mean, this is what I hear. You know, I've been through 1,000 drug trials in 40 years. So, I know what the proof is to show that somebody is a drug trafficker. However, an attorney by himself can't testify to that.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right. Well, and that is the problem. The other problem with this attorney down there was that he seemed to buy the concept of addiction that the prosecutor was promulgating. And that was that if you take the medicine every day, you're an addict. And the medicine says something completely contrary to that. The medicine says you could take it every day and, you know, you're just physically dependent. You know, an addict is a completely different thing. And so what he did really was kind of, and this is what
You've got to explain that. You understand now? You're a jury of laymen, one of whom was quoted in the
They hear addicted versus what was the other phrase you
dependent.
Just used?
Dependent.
Yeah, physically dependent, and they think, well, those are the same thing.
No, they're not.
Yeah, but do you understand though that when you fight this in court. The jury, here I am, a federal narcotic agent. I think I know what you mean.
Yes.
But most layman juries are not going to understand that.
That's right. And also, what happened in that case, as I said, was the lawyer, the defense attorney there, didn't understand that distinction himself. So he
The fact that this distinction shouldn't be, I just want to say for the record, this distinction shouldn't be being drawn by a jury because it should never get in front of a jury. But that's another story entirely.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. But what's happened is that a lot of the agents out there, and this is what I'm trying to get across, is that a lot of the agents out there still think that just because someone takes these drugs every day or they take a lot, that they're an addict. And it's not true. It just doesn't work that way. People can take enormous doses and not be an addict at all. It has to do with how long you've been taking it, how extreme your pain was. Addiction is something entirely different. Addiction can happen to somebody taking a very, very small dose. Addiction can be something, but it's very rare, especially in people who take these drugs every day. It's like less than 2% of the people actually become addicted. The people who become addicted, the way they define it nowadays is they call that use despite harm. So you continue to use it despite the fact that your life's falling apart, that you're not working, whatever. That your life is going poorly because of the drugs. Well, Richard was just surviving because of the drugs, and he was trying to just get by and be a husband and be a father because of the drugs.
So to draw the distinction, when you say physically dependent, what you mean is you depend on them physically in order to get through the course of a day, not that you're hooked on them.
Well, but you also could be what we call hooked. You see, this is the thing that's so difficult. Physically dependent means that if you get off of them quickly, you could have a withdrawal syndrome.
Right.
That's all it means. But you would have that with blood pressure medicine or antidepressants.
You
would have that with a lot of drugs.
Gotcha.
Well, what's happened is because of the way we think about opioids, because we think about heroin and, you know, and all that, we think about addiction and kicking and all that, those talk, you know, about withdrawal and everything.
Right.
So we associate those ideas with the person who's physically dependent on those drugs. But it's a complete misunderstanding because people who take those drugs legitimately for pain, they're physically dependent. Yes, they're, quote, you could say hooked. They have to take them every day, both because they need them and because they're physically dependent. But they're not addicted. They're not addicts. They're sick people who are taking the medicine. But you see, when you're a sick person, how do you explain that? You see what I mean? They're put in a very awkward position. And this is the kind of thing that I want to warn society about. I want people to stop and think about it because the problem is we have a situation where people are being asked to account for the medicines. You know, you prove to me you're not an addict. You take that stuff every day. How come you tell me you're not an addict?
Well, supposing he said, well, maybe I am an addict, but if I'm an addict, I've lived my life in excruciating pain.
Right.
And supposing I am, do you want to call me a drug trafficker, which is what they did?
Yeah.
And,
well, but that's the statute. I mean, I don't think a lawyer could get anybody out of that.
Well, hold on. Once you accuse a man of being a drug trafficker, you now offer expert testimony that says he's not anything like a drug trafficker.
I agree.
Which, personally, I've been very successful in cases where I was brought in to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I only accepted cases where I clearly saw from the record that they were people like Richard Payers, or they were medical marijuana users. They were people who had no or very little resources. There wasn't, and the government had done absolutely no investigation that would show that they're drug traffickers. They merely stood on the statute and said they, and juries found them guilty. Juries, when there was expert testimony introduced that, oh no, in my opinion, as somebody who's been in narcotic enforcement in one form or another for 40 years, this man is not a drug trafficker or anything like a drug trafficker, you could see the juries literally light up. And now I see here that you had jurors come forward who, one was Dwayne Hills, who were disturbed at the role that they found themselves forced to play in convicting Mr. Payers.
Yes, absolutely.
And they were disturbed. They sat there. One said he sat there through the trial waiting for some evidence that he was a drug trafficker.
Mm-hmm.
But none came. But yet, I believe, right to the bottom, my now 40 years of training and experience tell me that if these attorneys had used expert opinion, they would have done more to turn this law around than all the demonstrations or anything that we're doing now.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And that's been one of the things we've found, is a lot of real, not very stalwart attorney behavior in these cases. We've seen it in our doctor cases, and we've seen it in Richard's case and in many of the other there's a real weakness or something
Siobhan,
in the defense
Siobhan.
Bar.
Yeah,
and I was just going to say again, I don't want to let go of the point that we're still talking about a federal agency that shouldn't be doing it this way in the first place. I mean, I understand the need for enforcement. I totally understand that. But this is so clearly misguided from the very start that the fact that it's getting into a courtroom, the fact that it is just...
Siobhan and Mark, I have to tell you, I'm still close with a lot of guys I served with in DEA, a lot of New York City cops who worked in the New York Joint Task Force, and these are people who would throw their badge on the ground rather than follow around a sick man like Mr. Pay.
I know.
I don't understand what's happening.
I don't either. I don't understand why. You see, this is the thing that's so troubling to me and why I got involved. It wasn't just for my personal matter. It was because my father was a criminal defense attorney, and I was raised in a household that really that put together the concept of rule of law and political freedom. And my father really instilled that in me. And what I came to see is that a routine kind of behavior on the part of agents and prosecutors, where they just do what they can get away with, that they're doing criminal prosecutions in order to get notches on their belt.
Oh, you're so right.
Well,
it's so wrong. It's such an abuse of their authority.
It is. It's like one of the shows that we did about miracle marijuana, and the patient name escapes me now, and I feel terrible about it. But this was somebody who was in a wheelchair. We had a picture of him on the front of our website.
Will Forster? Was that Will Forster?
Will Forster was
sentenced to 28 years.
But this guy was in. He was wearing a green T-shirt that had a marijuana leaf in it in this picture that we had. But the point is, his case was literally his house was overrun by this army of people, and it was typical. It was like Waco all over again.
Wow.
We need an excuse to justify our budget, so therefore we're gonna here we are, we're gonna be big bad heroes and go into this place and bust the big bad drug guy, when that's not the case.
You know the thing about it is, after 9/11, I studied what happened with Zakaria Moussaoui and how these FBI bureaucrats wouldn't even investigate him, and I said that had they given Zakaria Moussaoui to any of the DEA squads I know, 9/11 probably wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But not the people that I'm hearing about now.
Right.
Yeah. Something horrific is happening, changing. There's a disconnect going on, and I can't believe that a lawyer couldn't find. I mean, I happen to know of ex-DEA people who are fine. They're out there as expert witnesses and trial consultants, and all they had to do was be approached. I know that they would go to war against this kind of crap.
We have to take a break in about 30 seconds, but I just wanted to say, for any doctors or any law enforcement people who feel strongly about this, you know, or have an opinion about this or have changed the way that you operate because of this, send us an email. Visit the website and get in touch with us and let us know, because we follow up on stories all the time, and it would be great to get some other opinions. So
yeah, hang in there, Siobhan. We got a ways to go yet, and I want to make sure that we get this audience lined up or at least curious enough to go to your website and ours and to spread the damn word. That's your job, guys.
Yeah, so stand by. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to the Expert Witness Radio Show with Michael Levine. For more information on tonight's show, please visit our worldwide website at www.expertwitnessradio.org.
Hey, this is Mike Levine back again with you, you expert witness listeners, and you guys in the expert witness SWAT team of truth. I hope you're listening. And Mark, I mean, we've got listeners now. Mark from
Bangkok,
our website,
Thailand.
From Bangkok, Thailand to Buenos Aires,
all over
to
the world.
Bogota. And
for that matter, hello to you all over the world, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and you know, spread the word. Keep spreading the word. It's the only way change happens, guys.
It's true.
And I want to welcome back my guest, Siobhan Reynolds. And Siobhan Reynolds is a pain activist. Siobhan has a
Pain management activist.
Pain management activist. But
yeah,
you're
I don't
more
advocate pain, but I advocate
yeah, pain pain management. I'm not gonna touch that. And we are, again, our website is expertwitnessradio.org. If you miss this or you want somebody else to hear this show, spread the word, expertwitnessradio.org. And let me talk about Siobhan's website, which is Pain. Go ahead. What is the website?
It's the painreliefnetwork.org.
Painreliefnetwork.org. Let me
tell
you.
Right, and we're called PRN for short.
Yeah, we have Siobhan, and you can go on Siobhan's website, and there is a movie featuring. She has done a movie that is fantastic that had me climbing walls, enraged, sad, depressed.
Which is why Laura tries to keep you away from screens altogether now.
Yeah, I know she does.
Because it happens way too often.
She does, because I just can't believe it. I just can't believe men with badges would put somebody like Richard Payes under surveillance. And, you know, it reminds me, a lot of years ago, I was an assistant supervisor in the first DEA FBI drug task force. And I'm going to tell you a real incident. One of the FBI guys, who was really a nice guy, it quickly became apparent that the guy had very little experience in making arrests. And he'd been on the job for a lot of years, and after one kind of a wild scene on the street, I pulled him aside and I said, I won't say his name. I said, haven't you ever arrested like bad guys? And he said, what have you been doing, you know, up to now? Because I knew he had about 9 or 10 years on the job. And he said, well, I was in the communist squad. I said, what did you do? And he said, and this guy happened to be on the Bella Abzug squad.
Oh, my God.
I said, the Bella Abzug squad? He said, who did you piss off? I mean, I think I would rather have a screwdriver in my eye than run around with a badge and gun following Bella Abzug anywhere.
Yeah. And he said, oh, no, that's
well, here you are. The only thing I could think of as worse duty than the Bella Abzug squad is following around people like Richard Payers in a wheelchair, who can't make. He's got to take these pills just to stay alive, and then prosecuting him. I wonder what law school the prosecutor graduated. But as Mark and I are about to reveal in this Bush administration, crime by prosecutors pays.
It pays way too well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, we've been doing a series of shows on something called the House of Death. That is a Bush-named prosecutor down in Texas was actually caught by DEA as being the overseer of an undercover operation whereby one of his informers was committing murders and torture murders and setting people up.
And burying them in the backyard.
Burying them. You actually had DEA going after him. And the DEA agent, a top guy, was literally forced off the job when he tried to pursue murder charges against the prosecutor. Well, we just heard...
Drum roll, please.
We just heard that prosecutor has now, for his sterling performance in Texas, has been promoted.
Yeah.
he's now, they sent him to Washington to be a top attorney. This is all going to be, by the way, for you guys on our, it's all going to be on our fundraising drive, the House of Death. This is just too unbelievable. The mainstream media is not covering it,
as they are
not covering
this. Yeah, exactly.
It's astounding that, and I'm so glad you're out there, Siobhan. But let's go on with the Richard Payers case. It says he was tried three times. How did that happen?
Well, I think a couple of times the first time there was a mistrial, and the second time I think that the prosecutor had to drop it. I don't remember exactly. I was talking to his attorney recently about whether or not there were double jeopardy issues, and I'm still not clear. But I think what Richard's perception of it was, and Linda too, is that once he put up a fight and he wasn't willing to just roll over and be a statistic, which is really what it's about.
Explain that. He was offered,
was it a month or a year? 1 year. 1 year probation they offered him. They arrest him. They tell him 25 years is
if he did what?
And then they offer him a year probation.
If he pled guilty.
If he pled guilty?
Yeah, if he pled guilty to, I guess, some minor form of the same offense. I don't know. He wouldn't do it. He just wouldn't do it. He couldn't stand to testify against himself and lie.
Right.
Ends up going to prison for 25 years.
Yeah, he would have had to get on the witness stand and said, yes, I'm a drug trafficker.
Right. He would have had to, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing about Richard is he just couldn't. And he felt terrible about it. He wanted to do it, I mean, for his wife and his children, but he just couldn't really bring himself to do it. And the idea that this guy, this prosecutor into this whole system, wanted him to do that, that just blows my mind. I can't believe it.
I have to tell you that a lot of times when we do the show, Mike gets a lot of the information together, and he usually comes with more of it than I do. And I did not know Richard's story. And I was sitting here before, and you were telling the story, and there were tears in my eyes because I could not believe. I mean, it's a heartbreaking enough story that here you are, you have a family man with children whose weekly existence is tenuous at best on account of what he's been through. I mean, just the surgery alone, not to mention the original incident. Yeah. And to have this being done to him is just, it's a travesty.
Well, what I think America has a right to know is how much money did it cost to prosecute this man in a wheelchair? How much money did it cost to have agents putting him under surveillance? I understand they even got the doctor to testify against him.
Yeah, they did.
How did they do that? They must have scared the absolute crap.
They told the doctor that he was going to be looking at 25 years and for these prescriptions. You see, the problem with the way the law works is that because they've got the criminal law, you know, everything's criminalized, and then you've got the drugs in the inside, you know, they're supposed to be legal drugs. The problem is, if you make a mistake, if you do something you're not supposed to do, it's sort of up for the cop to decide whether he wants to criminalize that or not. And so when the mistake had been made, right, we were talking about interstate and faxing and all
right.
that kind of stuff, administrative things. Well, the prosecutor was in a position to basically say to the guy, well, okay, you know, it's you or Richard. And so the guy says, oh, well, I think we'll have Richard go to prison instead of me. And so that's basically what happened. And the guy's testimony was a joke, and it was absolutely all over the place. And the only thing he didn't change while he was testifying was his name. I mean, he was unbelievable, this guy. But you see, the people have to understand, the propaganda has been so strong about these drugs and about all this for so long that we don't realize that it's affecting legal drugs. We don't understand that it's affecting people's minds about this stuff.
Mike and I were listening to that news clip before airtime, and I had mentioned when they started talking about OxyContin about the whole Rush Limbaugh story,
mm-hmm.
and how when you look at the time when they did the crackdown, that's when it was.
Yes.
It was it became very visible because he was. Do you think that's the case?
Well, you got to wonder. I don't really know about the timing of that, and I'm a little bit curious about it because I don't really understand. Why so public? And you know, they went after him. But what's interesting about him as a case in contrast to Richard is that he is wealthy mm-hmm. and he is capable of getting really good attorneys. So he's been holding them off this whole
right.
time.
No, but my point was in terms of there are a whole bunch of us who'd never heard of OxyContin
yes.
until that happened.
Yeah,
and
but it wasn't just that. The government did a whole campaign. Action Plan, they called it, the OxyContin Action Plan. And it basically came around right after the OMB found that the DEA had not been able to demonstrate any success in keeping drugs off the streets in the United States. And
really?
So then all of a sudden, that's not the problem anymore. The
yeah.
problem now is prescription drug abuse.
Hey, wait, look over here.
Oh, yeah, God. Right, basically. And look at what an easy bunch of people to get. You
sure.
know, you're shooting fish in a barrel now.
Exactly.
You
know? They're not going to be chugging away from you or anything. Oh,
people
man.
People are going to, sure, and they pay taxes and they sign on the bottom line and they don't shoot back. And, you know, it's all very easy. And it's so distressing to me. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I saw them turn back on medical practice. And what's really sad, too, is that now it's starting to come out that the drugs in the street are there mostly, or we know that tons and tons of, literally millions of dosage units are coming off of pharmacy robberies out the back door, right?
Right.
And
oh,
nobody's
yeah.
doing anything about that.
Yeah.
That
well,
part, nobody's doing anything about.
Well, let me make this really clear for the audience that there is a huge difference. There are doctors who, for different reasons, become absolutely criminal. They set up prescription mills where they just sell to addicts on the street. There's
mm-hmm.
no doubt about it. OxyContin is one of those drugs. But those cases do not come about the way these cases are now coming about,
yeah.
where you go through records and you do no investigation and you find somebody, some individual like this poor man crippled in pain, Richard Payes, who is clearly not a drug dealer, and you focus this multi-million dollar effort at prosecuting him, that is not what men with gun and badges are for. You know what the shame is? What I would love to know, how much money and time and prosecutorial effort was spent in this time when we know that drug trafficking and terrorism are hand in hand.
Exactly.
Who's the prosecutor?
Name is Scott Andringa. He's no longer prosecuting in that area. I don't know what he's up to.
I bet they moved
point.
Him up.
Yeah.
Oh, he's in Florida. Yeah.
That's what Linda was saying. He'll probably get promoted.
Yeah, well, I hope you're proud of yourself, Scott.
Well, you know, part of the key here, again, you know, you brought up, Mark brought up astutely, I think, Rush Limbaugh, because what the Rush Limbaugh OxyContin case showed is that these cases get headlines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the elephant in the refrigerator when it comes to prosecutors, and as you pointed out, I've dealt with hundreds, if not thousands of them, is there are a hell of a lot of them. Too many who are just career-minded and win-minded and will do anything to win. And it's
yeah.
disgusting, and it's sickening, and it's damaging to our whole justice system, but they're out there. Now, we've got to – the only way this is turned around is with good lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Good
well,
lawyers.
We're working on it. I mean,
yeah.
that's what PRN was formed to do. PRN was formed to start looking at these cases, start bringing lawyers in to the fold – start trying to reach out to the better people, trying to get everybody's talking about, you know, because there's so many trips and little mistakes and things that people were doing here, failures that people were making, basic criminal law 101 type failures. And we wanted to start bringing the community together to fight them. So there's the big Justice Department and then there's us.
Well, you got us in your corner, Shob.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad.
Shob, and you know, again, everybody listening, you guys remember, these are tens of millions, or if I have, is there any idea, Chauvin, of how widespread this is across the country? I mean,
yeah.
From my point of view, it seems when you add in the prosecution of medical marijuana patients with cancer and the making of fugitives of people,
not
like
to mention the whole investigatory aspect of it.
Well, that's
of time.
What I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, that's a
you know,
huge
these
amount
guys,
of money.
These helicopters and SWAT teams, and you know, I've been called in on cases where
yeah, boys,
I am
boys with toys.
Yeah, well, you know, years ago I used to be an operational inspector with the Office of Professional attached to the Office of Professional Responsibility. In those years, if you had given me a case like these guys are bringing to court now, I would be honestly, you know, checking the sanity of people running it.
But the problem is a lot of these guys go out and they do this stuff and then they succeed. See, it's like all about show. Like I almost feel like that. They're putting on this with the helicopters and the guns and the SWAT teams and all that in order to make it look like something's going on there. Because it's like I saw a case in Indiana recently where they literally did all that kind of stuff, and they came in and they took a whole clinic's worth of people and they took them out and put them on the floor and put their hands behind their back and tied. These are sick people who were sitting in a medical clinic. There was a woman there who had a oxygen mask, and they handcuffed her when she had an oxygen mask on. I mean, you see that and you think, what are we coming to? Where do we lose track of our values?
Well, I hate to say that, but in 1997, myself and three other federal agents, Ralph McGehee of Central Intelligence with 25 years, Wes Swearingen, 25 years with the FBI, Dennis Dale, 27 years with DEA, and myself with 25 years with DEA, got together, and we predicted everything that's happening now.
One of the aspects that you talked about, which is and Stan Goff talks about this too, is about the militarization of smaller law enforcement organizations,
mm-hmm.
where their budgets, where they're now, you know, you got police departments now that are being handed entire SWAT team outfits, complete
yeah,
with all
I
the equipment.
Yeah, I wish I knew the number, but it's gone sky high.
Absolutely, and they have to, and again, we're not necessarily talking about federal agents at that point. And it's again, this is why I brought up Waco before, is when you think about the start of Waco, where when you think about the way they handled it at the start, they were obviously going in guns blazing. They had every intention of it. I mean, going up and shooting the dogs at the start of it. I mean, there was no level-headed thought, and that's what's. What's interesting to me is what's in the mindset of somebody when you're actually physically – what Siobhan was just saying. When you're walking up to a woman with an oxygen mask on and you're putting her down on the floor and you're putting handcuffs,
well,
where is your mind?
No, that's my point. My point of view is hampered with the experience of having done that a few thousand times, you know, having led men with guns, warrants, bulletproof vests. You know, going into situations where, in most of these cases, we ended up facing people who were heavily armed with a lot of money, and there was a certain kind of satisfaction. A good number of them had committed murders. I felt blessed that I was able to do this. I felt that, God had given me a license to hunt the most dangerous animal on earth. If you look back on my record, and I have to be very careful what I say because I testify in court all the time, and sure enough, I guarantee you some of these prosecutors will go back and look. So you're not going to find anything even remotely like these cases. I wouldn't do it. I just couldn't do it and go home to my wife. I couldn't do it and go to sleep at night. I just don't understand how this can be done, how you can go into a clinic of sick people with an arrest warrant, lay them down on the floor, handcuff them behind their back, how you can do a surveillance on a man who's obviously living from hand to mouth, suffering day to day, but he's not, his prescriptions are not kosher, and then prosecute him to the extent where he's now doing 25 years in prison is so far beyond me, Mark, that I'm almost tongue-tied here.
Is Richard, to the best of your knowledge, Siobhan, is Richard being given any kind of pain management in
yeah,
prison?
Yeah, he is. Before he went in, he made sure that he moved over to a pump, so he has a morphine pump. And actually, when he went in, he was taking the equivalent, before he went to the pump, he was taking the equivalent of 23 pills a day. That was the amount that the prosecutors found so outrageous.
I'm sitting here smacking myself in the forehead because I'm sitting here thinking, okay, well, guess what? We're not going to let you do it in your house,
but
we'll lock
jail.
You in a cell for 25 years, and we'll give you the drugs.
And we'll pay for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, and he has the thing in his back now, and he has the equivalent of, you know, over 100 pills a day now in there because he's finally titrated properly. But you know what? Every time it comes up for refill, they sort of dangle it over us whether or not they're going to refill it. And, you know, that's torture right there. And I wish there was some way to, you know, if we had all the resources in the world, you bet I'd go after the state of Florida for that. Because it's outrageous that they would treat a human being that way and try to make him afraid that he's going to end up in pain in his own body.
Well, you've got a resource here, and I just want to say to all the listeners, please go to the website, expertwitnessradio.org. The show is right on the front page. Send out a link to other people. Send the MP3 file to people. Get other people involved and outraged, because this has nothing whatsoever to do with Homeland Security, you know?
Yes, it does.
No, I know what you mean, but I'm saying...
Big time.
This is money that should not be being spent on this.
Yeah, and you know? And men with guns, badges, SWAT teams, helicopters,
right.
Prosecutors, federal or state prosecutors, yeah, you're talking about probably across the country hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to prosecute people who are already in horrific pain. Is this what the justice system is for? This is awful. And this is something that everybody listening, you should spread the word. I urge you also to go on to painreliefnetwork.org. That's Siobhan Reynolds' website, and you can see she put an hour movie right on the front page. Anybody can watch it, and I urge
you.
There's
a bunch of resources there. Yeah. There's a bunch of video and audio, and it's a great site, people should educate themselves. So, Siobhan, in the whopping 3.5 minutes that we have left, anything you want to say to the audience in terms of encouraging stuff going forward?
One of the things people need to realize is that the costs of doing this, apart from all the prosecution and all that stuff, we're talking about the cost of undertreated pain. You know, 50 million people are in undertreated pain, and probably maybe somewhere like a million of them have access to opioid pain care. So you're saying that 49 million people in the United States of America don't have access to the simplest drug that's been around since the beginning of time, that is absolutely non-toxic and is the best drug. And here we have these drugs like Vioxx. These things are killing people. This affects everybody. There are, I don't even know how many, but when you look at it, you add it all up, at least 100,000 people a year are dying as a result, unnecessarily, of pain medicine gone awry. That is, people are pushing and doctors are pushing because they don't feel comfortable prescribing what they ought to be prescribing. And so the costs to the society, the fact that hospitals work this way, the fact that little babies with cancer are not getting, you know, opioid pain care that would actually put them out of pain while they die. I mean, we really need to step back and look at ourselves and say, is this who we wanted to become? You know, is this the society that we wanted to be? Because we've gone so far in enforcement and so far in being tough, and we don't do anything about being measured anymore, and we don't seem to care about, you know, whether or not we're taking a sane and safe approach to our own society. And that's what I think. I mean, I think we need to take a look around, because this is really scary.
I'm still gasping at the notion that there are 15 million potential investigative targets out there for us to spend billions in putting in jail. 15 million people in pain, is that about right?
No, 50 million. 50 million people in pain, 49 million of them unable to access the opioid pain care. So you've got the million who get the opioids. Say you could put them all in jail, because all you have to do is say that they got them illegally somehow. And how are you going to do that? Go scare their doctor into saying that.
Hey, I'll go get President Bush's ear. I'll get a whole new agency under me.
Oh, man.
I'll get you guys.
Uh-huh.
You think you're in trouble now in your wheelchair.
Oh, man.
Wait till the Levine Raiders.
Don't even say that.
I'd do anything to get in the news. I'll do anything to get...
Well, apparently they will, won't they?
I know, they will.
Yeah.
They really have. And it's all been since 2000. And you know, the other thing, Dr. Hurwitz, when I went and watched the opening testimony on that trial, the prosecutors were up there talking. The whole room was full of federal agents. There must have been 150 federal agents with their butts in those seats. And I couldn't believe it.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
I thought, how much money we were saying,
I was just
gonna
say,
just
and,
for
and
that.
They're all being paid to be there.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Well, we out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time.
Siobhan,
yeah, go ahead. Thank
go ahead.
You.
No, you do.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me on, and I really appreciate it. It was wonderful, and the patients in America appreciate it.
Our radio doors are always open to you. And again, I want to stress, anybody out there, you know, doctors, law enforcement professionals, you know, hear this and you want to respond to it, send us an email, you know, and let us know how you feel.
Yeah, we want to put you on the air. Let's go to war, guys.
There you go.
This is for the betterment of all of us, and I mean it. And this, honey, Laura Cavanaugh, my wife, are you proud of me now, baby? I'm coming home. This is Mike Levine.
And we will see you folks next week. You all take care.
Take care. Bye.